Hi everyone, welcome to our next installment of Encounters with Jesus. These are episodes from the Gospel of Mark, where we learn how people interact with Jesus and respond to him, and we see glowing examples of persistent faith, and we see examples of those who reject Christ and harden their hearts. And in the previous story we looked at, Jesus heals a blind man. It's an enacted parable where Jesus heals the blind man in stages, first partially and then completely, and the Lord's action was an illustration for his disciples that what he wanted them to do with their spiritual blindness, or what he could do for them in their spiritual blindness, is take them gently by the hand and lead them into the light. And after the healing of the blind man, the light shines through now, brighter, through Peter's grand confession of who Jesus is. And it marks a turning point in Mark's gospel as the shadow of the cross begins to loom larger and Jesus begins to set his face to go to Jerusalem, here giving a prediction of what his ministry from here on out is going to look like. So Mark chapter 8, verses 27 through 33. And Jesus went on with his disciples to the villages of Caesarea Philippi, and on the way he asked his disciples, "Who do people say that I am?" And they told him, "John the Baptist, and others say Elijah, and others one of the prophets." And he asked them, "But who do you say that I am?" Peter answered him, "You are the Christ." And he strictly charged them to tell no one about him. And he began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and the chief priests and the scribes, and be killed, and after 3 days rise again. And he said this plainly. And Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. But turning and seeing his disciples, he rebuked Peter and said, "Get behind me, Satan, for you are not setting your mind on the things of God, but on the things of man." In 1883, a woman named Mary Malone immigrated to the United States, and she made her living as a domestic servant, usually as a cook for different households. And from 1900 to 1907, Mary was working, nearly two dozen people fell ill with typhoid fever in the households in New York City and Long Island where Mary was employed. And when investigators tried to track down the source of the disease, Mary had already fled the scene. And you probably already guessed who this is. This typhoid Mary, as she became known, was this asymptomatic carrier of the typhoid bacteria, and she was immune to the disease herself but was able to spread it to others. And initially it seemed she was unaware that she was passing it along to the people that she worked for, but once discovered, the public health officials made her promise never to cook again, never to become an employee like this. But she reneged on her promise, needed to earn a living, and caused additional outbreaks, and she was eventually taken by the public health officials and permanently quarantined for the final 23 years of her life. Now, what would it be like to discover that you were unwittingly contaminating people with a potentially lethal disease? Would you be terrified, perplexed, confused? I mean, this is a question that's in the news even now during this pandemic. Are you an asymptomatic carrier of this coronavirus and able to spread it to others? Well, in this passage, it's like Peter becomes an unwitting, an unknowing carrier of demonic doctrine, as he basically takes Jesus aside and tells him to abandon his redemptive mission, to dismiss the Father's will, to take the easy route to exaltation. Jesus, put these thoughts of suffering and death and sacrifice aside, put them out of your mind. We're not about defeat, Jesus, we're about victory. And as Pastor Kent Hughes comments, Peter's voice was laced with demonic typhoid. One minute he confesses that Jesus is the Christ, the next minute he's obstructing Jesus' path to the cross, trying to talk Jesus out of his redemptive mission. Now, Peter's confession here is one of the high points of Mark's gospel, his confession along with Jesus then predicting his passion, his death, turned the narrative in a new direction, as Jesus will begin to teach his disciples and unfold to them the suffering that he is going to expect. And the story is marked here by various opinions about Christ. So we'll hear various opinions about who Jesus is. There's a confession of a declaration of who Jesus is, of his true identity. There's a turning point as the text now moves in a different direction. And then there's a rebuke from Jesus to Peter. So those are our four points today. First of all, opinion. Opinions, various opinions are offered about the identity of Jesus. Verse 27, Jesus went on with his disciples to the villages of Caesarea Philippi, and on the way he asked his disciples, "Who do people say that I am?" Now this is great. Jesus is the model discipler. He's always redeeming the time. Even as they walk from one place to the next, he's seizing these free moments to teach them and instruct them and interact with his disciples. This is what we should be doing with our children. This is what we should be doing with our friends when we have the moments, when we have those times where we're riding in the car, we're walking someplace. Are we seizing those moments to help instruct them in the ways of godliness, in the ways of Jesus? So it's on the way to Caesarea Philippi that Jesus raises the issue of his identity. A seemingly mundane moment turns into one of the high points of Mark's gospel, a very pivotal, crucial passage. They're now on the way to Jesus' humiliation, rejection, suffering, and death, showing that faith and discipleship cannot be rendered from the sideline, removed from the risk. And Jesus invites the disciples to sift through all the various popular opinions that were being offered about his identity and mission. Who do people say that I am? What's the word on the street? That's a rather bold question, a courageous question to ask. If I were to go up to somebody or a friend or relative and say, who do people say that I am? Or what do people say that I'm like? There's a bit of vulnerability here, but Jesus he's trying to instruct and teach his disciples. What's the popular opinion? What's the word on the street? Now, Mark has already answered this question in the first verse of the whole gospel, the beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. The question has already been raised and answered. When Jesus heals the paralytic in Mark chapter 2, the Pharisees ask, how could any true servant of God speak like that? The disciples on the Sea of Galilee, who then is this, that even the winds and the waves obey him? King Herod, wondering about the true identity of Jesus. So the question has been raised in Mark's gospel. And the answer has been given implicitly through exorcisms and healings and walking on the water, feeding the multitudes, and now it's stated explicitly. Jesus says, who do people say that I am? They said, John the Baptist, others say Elijah, others one of the prophets. So Jesus ranks alongside some of the brightest and impressive luminaries from Israel's history. John the Baptist, he's a popular teacher, had a great following who listened to him and heard his teaching. He's highly esteemed by the people, even the aristocracy. People from every class and walk of life esteemed John the Baptist. Herod was convinced that Jesus was John the Baptist, raised from the dead to avenge his murder. And apparently the people had perpetuated these rumors. Oh, he's John the Baptist. This is who Jesus is, a resurrected John the Baptist. Some says he's Elijah. You know, Elijah didn't actually die. He was, there's no record of his death. He was taken up into heaven in a fiery chariot. And there was a Jewish expectation that Elijah would return and make an appearance. Malachi 4, verse 5, "Behold, I will send you Elijah the prophet before that great and awesome day of the Lord comes." Maybe Jesus is Elijah, resurrected in some other form. Or maybe Jesus is one of the Old Testament prophets, like Moses, Deuteronomy 18, 15, predicting that another prophet would come. So what do these answers reveal? John the Baptist, Elijah, some prophet from the Old Testament. The people recognized Jesus was an impressive luminary speaking with God's authority, that God had sent him. And this is a question that's still being asked today. Who is Jesus? It's one of the most important questions you can ask. World religions have given alternative answers. The Muslims, they say Jesus is a great prophet, second only to Muhammad in importance, and that his true mission was obscured when he was deified by his followers. That's what the Muslims say. The Gnostics, New Age Hindu-type religions, Jesus is this enlightened mystic whose spiritual knowledge can bring about a higher consciousness and union with the divine. The Mormons say Jesus is the brother of Satan, the physical son of a union between Jehovah God and Mary. Jehovah's Witnesses, Jesus is an exalted created being, otherwise known as Michael the Archangel. So there are these vast and varied opinions about who is Jesus. It's a great question to ask. If you walk up on the street, I think that the general impression of who Jesus is probably someone that I remake in my own image. That's what you're going to get from any person on the street. Maybe some some impressions that I have from history or from the news about who Jesus is, and then I'm going to recast that, remold that in my own image, showing popular culture's ignorant or even blasphemous depictions of who Jesus is. So there are many, many popular opinions about who Jesus is. Who do you say that he is? So we turn from opinions then to confession. Confession here in the sense of a declaration of one's identity. Jesus presses them further in verse 29. So he asks them, "But who do you say that I am?" Now there's a double emphasis in the words "but" and "you." But you, who do you say that I am? Jesus wants his disciples to state their own personal belief. He's looking for conviction. What is your conviction about my identity? You know, it's always less risky, less daunting for me to state and defend what other people believe. But Jesus is pressing in on the disciples here to form and express their own convictions about him. They can't just second the views of others comfortably from the sidelines. They must step out from under the umbrella of majority opinion. Yes, we know the majority opinion is that you are John the Baptist, or you're Elijah, or you're one of the prophets. But who do you say that I am? Faith expresses itself in a public confession of Jesus, a public acknowledgement that Jesus is Lord. You cannot confess your faith through a proxy vote. I must personally close with Christ. I must personally put my trust in him and announce my allegiance to him. And look here at Peter's answer in verse 29. You are the Christ. And that's what Jesus wanted to hear. And Matthew's gospel records his joyous response. Blessed are you, Simon Bar-Jonah, for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father who is in heaven. And I tell you, you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. So this tremendous affirmation from Jesus in Matthew's gospel, why Mark chose not to include that affirmation from Christ, we can only guess, maybe because Peter was Mark's primary source and he's being humble and doesn't want to include that affirmation here in his recounting of the history of the event to Mark. But here we have the first time in the Gospel of Mark when a human being, a human person, makes this identification. To this point, God has made this confession. You are the Christ. This is my beloved Son. The demons have confessed who Christ is, that he is God, that he has the power of the Son of God. They had testified to his true identity. And now Peter's answer, you know, we've made this progression throughout Mark chapter 8 from a sort of fuzzy, foggy blindness about Jesus' identity and mission to now here, Peter's answer is bathed in light. The blinders seem to be falling away. His heart is softening. He's thinking more clearly. You, Jesus, are the Christ. Well, at least for now, we're soon going to discover that Peter has both right and wrong ideas about Jesus as Messiah. He's kind of like the blind man after stage one of healing. He sees figures blurrily, men like trees walking, he says. The figures are blurry and fuzzy. He is correct in that Jesus is the Christ. He is the promised Messiah foretold by the Old Testament prophets. He will accomplish God's salvation, but Peter is wrong because he misunderstands the Messiah's role. And he will eventually rebuke Jesus when he talks about his predicted death. He can't conceive of a Messiah that will suffer and die. But Peter's identifying Jesus as the Christ, the Messiah, the anointed one, meant the disciples believed that Jesus was the one Israel had been waiting for since the time of David, this superhuman leader who would overthrow Israel's enemies and make Jerusalem and Palestine the center of the world, establishing the perfect reign of God. And this is why Jesus strictly charged them to tell no one about him, there in verse 30. Jesus is very cautious about his public self-revelation. Peter says it, and then all of the disciples nod in agreement. Maybe some like Simon the Zealot or Judas Iscariot were hanging everything on their political hopes that this Messiah belief inspired. So from opinions and confession, now we come to number three, turning point. Yes, the disciples still have some misinformed opinions about Jesus' ultimate sacrifice. Their messianic expectations are skewed in the direction of a militaristic, conquering, powerful hero, and Jesus just swiftly undercuts those expectations and begins to lead them to the truth. I must suffer. The Son of God must suffer. He says in verse 31, he began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and the chief priests and the scribes and be killed, and after 3 days rise again. This is a prediction of his passion. Jesus predicts his coming suffering. The whole complex of events that were surrounding his passion, what we call his passion, his suffering and death, whether it was his arrest and trial, his humiliation, beatings, mockery, the agony of the cross, all of that comes under this heading of the many things that he's going to suffer. Jesus will experience wholesale religious rejection from the religious establishment, the Sanhedrin, composed of the elders, chief priests, and scribes. Jesus would be killed, not by a lawless mob, but by Israel's religious leaders. And he emphasizes the necessity of it. Jesus must. He says, I must suffer many things. Jesus did not say that the Son of Man would suffer or might suffer. He said he must suffer. Now, that's a very important word. It controls the whole sentence here. Everything in this list is a necessity. Jesus must suffer. Jesus must be rejected and killed and resurrected. He's planning to die. He's doing it voluntarily. Without the shedding of blood, there can be no forgiveness of sins, we're told in Hebrews 9:22. Without the sacrifice of his body on the cross, there would be no satisfaction for sins. There would be no satisfaction of God's holy law. He must die, because without his death as a propitiatory offering, sinners could never have life. He must suffer, because without his vicarious sufferings, our sins could never be taken away. So, opinion, confession, turning point, and finally there is this rebuke. Peter rebukes Jesus in verse 32. And he said this plainly. So Jesus isn't speaking in parables. He's speaking the bold, plain, unvarnished truth, concealing nothing. He laid it all out on the line. He was going to the cross. This is what you should expect from the Messiah, that he will suffer. Now, this is inexplicable to Peter. Peter has other ideas in mind. And he takes him aside, verse 32 says, and began to rebuke him. It's one thing for Jesus to say, I'm going to fight, we'll be defeated. It's another thing to say, this is why I came. I intend to die. I must suffer. And Peter could not stand for that defeatist talk. He expects a Messiah who would defeat the Romans, reestablish an autonomous kingdom of Israel. And the language here suggests that Peter communicates this to Jesus with an air of protective superiority, as if he came alongside of Jesus, put his arm around Jesus, and just kind of whispers to him, Jesus, come here. Of course I believe that you are the Messiah. I've just confessed that you are the Christ. But you have your information wrong. You have to stop this talk about suffering and death, or you're going to lose all credibility. I'm here to help you. I'm here to guide you. Peter rebukes Jesus. Jesus rebukes Peter. As verse 33 says, he rebuked Peter and said, get behind me, Satan, for you are not setting your mind on the things of God, but on the things of man. So Mark's suggesting here that as Jesus turns to look at Peter, address Peter, he sees the other disciples behind him who are in agreement with what Peter has just said. So this rebuke is directed at Peter, but it's meant for all the disciples to hear, for all of their expectations to be realigned. Jesus responds to them all, addressing this error promptly, as Peter has become this unwitting carrier of demonic doctrine, basically telling Jesus that you need to abandon your redemptive mission, disregard the Father's will, go the easy route to exaltation. Jesus, put these thoughts of suffering and defeat out of your mind. What is this but a suggestion that's laced with demonic typhoid? One minute he's confessing that Jesus is the Christ, the next minute he's trying to block Jesus from going to the cross. So Jesus says, get behind me, Satan. The same words that Jesus spoke to the devil in the wilderness during his temptation, according to Matthew 4:10. They're shocking words. He identifies Peter with Satan, the arch enemy of God, father of lies. Because to avoid the cross, the centerpiece of Mark's gospel would be diabolical to the extreme. Peter shows that he's more concerned with the things of man, the love of power, status, his own comfort and ease. And human weakness and depravity desire the path of least resistance and greatest power. So here you have the turning point. Our souls can only be saved through faith in a suffering Messiah, one who suffers for us on the cross, who dies for us, and who is raised. And we affirm it every week when we confess the Apostles' Creed. He suffered under Pontius Pilate. And why were the disciples rejecting Jesus as a suffering Messiah? The idea was out of sync with human reasoning. Who would ever design a method of saving the world that would include suffering and death? None of us would. We want people to come and save us with power, with militaristic might. But Jesus says, if you think that way, you're definitely not setting your mind on the things of God, but on the things of man. The weakness of God is more powerful than man. Confessing Christ means embracing a Messiah who is bound for the cross. Who is Jesus? Jesus asked this question of his disciples. He asked this question of us. He asks it of everybody. Who do you say that I am? The answer comes back very clear. He is the Son of God, crucified in weakness, but risen in power and coming again for all who trust in him, who own him, love him, who follow him.